Sun Brothers, the revolution will be live.
Revelation Radio, Wednesdays at 11. Good morning and welcome to Finding Your Way Home, Real Talk on Real Estate. My name is Sherry Doherty and I am your host weekly at 10 a.m. on Mondays. Today, I am delighted to have with me a special guest in studio, my colleague in business and my partner on the Stage One Real Estate team, Robert Francis. And Rob is a 29-year military veteran who is going to talk to us today about military moves and house hunting season because it is very close to now, and Rob is going to talk to us all about that. So welcome, Rob.
Hi, Sherry.
Thank you for joining us. Just because, first and foremost, we should thank you for your service. So thank you for all the years that you served this country. We all greatly appreciate it. And just to introduce yourself to people, can you tell us a little bit about your career, what you did throughout your time, and maybe how many times you and your family moved?
I was in the artillery for a little over 29 years. I spent most of my time out in the East Coast, out in New Brunswick, which is where I met my wife and all my family's from. And I was posted there several times internally on base Gagetown. I was posted to Kingston twice, which is why I really liked this place and eventually retired here. And the last couple years that I was in the military, my family and I, we moved 3 times in 4 years.
Oh, my goodness. So you've gotten very good at this.
Yeah. So I'm pretty familiar with the relocation directive and military moves.
Right. Okay. Well, now you've chosen to have a second career in real estate. It's just a different way to serve our community. But with all that experience in your pocket, and given that we are a military town, there are so many people to help and assist in this way. I know that we are now coming upon, people are getting their posting notices and people are coming on what is referred to as an HHT. And before I was in real estate, I didn't know what an HHT was, but I now know that it's a house hunting trip. And I actually had my own personal experience because my son-in-law is in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, and I went on his HHT with him to help them buy their first home. But can you explain a little bit to people about what it means that people are now getting their posting notices and then what happens during the house hunting trip, because that's a frenzy of activity and that's coming to our market very soon.
Yeah, your house hunting trip. It's the start of a stressful, well, it can be a stressful period of time for when you're moving. Everyone should know or will know shortly if they're posted to their new duty station or wherever they're going. So they get the message, and the message is actually the important part because that is what gives you the authority to start booking moves, booking hotels, talking to realtors, getting your house ready to sell or buy. It basically gives you the financial authority to start the process of your move.
Okay, so it means you're officially moving.
Yes, yeah. When you get your posting message, you are definitely moving at that
point. Okay. And this is really important to people in our market because both for people who are part of the military world, but other buyers and sellers who aren't need to be aware of this, because if you're planning to buy a house right now, you're about to have a lot of competition. There are a lot of people moving into Kingston from other military locations. And if you're planning to sell, this is one of the best times to make sure your house is on the market to get maximum exposure.
Oh, definitely. If you live in, for example, Kingston or any other base town, what you want to do is, if you're near a lot of military in your neighborhood, you want to sell, it would be a good time to get your house ready so you can take advantage of all the people that are going to start looking for homes in the neighborhood if you have a lot of military neighbors.
Right. Okay. Is there a base that most frequently transfers to Kingston?
It's tricky to say because there's so many different units here at CFB Kingston. They have the headquarters, they have the schools, they have operational units here. So there's Kingston is a very big draw for a lot of Army bases and some Air Force as well, too, with the helicopter squadron here.
Okay. That makes perfect sense. Okay. So starting from getting your actual first official posting notice, can you talk us through what the process looks like for people kind of step by step? I know it might be a bit of a long process, and I'll interject kind of some layperson's questions, if I may.
Sure thing.
And if you can take us through the whole process, that would be great.
Okay, certainly. Just keep in mind that sometimes this is not a sequential step.
Like, okay.
These things have to be done, but not necessarily in this order. So I'm just going to go over the most common steps of a posting posting. First off, you receive your message. And once you get that, that's when you start looking at where you're going. So you take a look at the market or the area where you're going to be going. Like if you're going to Ottawa, for example.
Okay.
So you'd look at realtors that are in that area. You'd find out where you want to live, determine where you live. If you're not sure of the area, that's where you're having a local realtor really helps out, because you can ask them, are they close to the base, schools that you want, any recreational facilities that you're looking for, or needs like schools or special schools like Montessori's or anything like that.
Okay.
So once you start that, you look at your where you're going, talk to a realtor, then you start booking your house hunting trip. And that is where a house hunting trip is where the spouses can go on to the new location and start looking for a place. So it's your actual official, I'm looking for a home in my new, in what's going to be your new town.
Right.
So at that point, you book flights out. You have to go through BGRS or Brookfield, the relocation services that the military uses. So you book everything through them for your flights, your travel. You get to your new city, and that's when you meet your realtor and the house hunting trip starts. So it is a very short period of time. You normally have 5 days.
Right.
And it's busy. Mm-hmm. So in 5 days, you have to find houses in the area that you want to live in, go visit them, see them, decide which ones you want, and then make offers, and hopefully that you are successful. It is possible that you do go on a house hunting trip and end up not successful finding a home on your first trip.
Okay. Can you get a subsequent trip if you were unsuccessful?
You can, but at that point, it's going to be out of your own pocket.
Okay.
For expenses. So, which is why having a, like working with a realtor who is really aware of your short timelines is really important.
Absolutely.
You want to squeeze as many showings in as you can in such a short period of time.
Yeah. So two things I would add to that is when I went with my daughter, there were only so many houses for sale in her budget. Or their budget, sorry. And so we literally saw all six. It's Moose Jaw. It's not the biggest place in the world. And there was only so many in their budget that were available and for sale at that time. They weren't during this big spring push. He's Air Force. And so we were there in November, which is typically a more quiet time for real estate. And so we saw all five or six houses. The first four were not a chance. And then fortunately, we did fall in love with the one that they're currently living in, and we were successful in negotiating it. But it was very stressful because in that time, we also had to get a home inspection. And I'm sure you're getting there, but there's lots of things that, had to happen. And then to your point of working with a military experienced realtor, I think that's really important. And reaching out to someone who is well connected to put you in charge. Like, I wouldn't profess to be able to assist you in Moose Jaw, but now I know a great military expert in Moose Jaw who could help somebody. I have somebody now coming from Moose Jaw. I guess we could all guess where I got that referral from, coming from Moose Jaw to Trenton. But you should be in touch with them earlier, because I've been already talking to him. I've already set him up on the search engine, and then we're talking almost daily on what comes up, because he'll make comments about what he likes and what he doesn't like. And he's putting together a watch list so that when he does come for his house hunting trip at the end of April, that we're going to have a really good solid list of ones we know that he absolutely wants to see and be the most efficient with our time as possible. So I highly suggest that people be in touch early, right?
Oh, definitely. The earlier you get in touch with a realtor, the better off you are. That way you can see homes, because obviously not everything will be still for sale when you get
right
there, but it gives you an idea of the prices in certain neighborhoods, which neighborhoods are popular. So it really helps to have that information.
Mm-hmm.
You did mention earlier about posted out of sequence, like in November.
Right.
House hunting trips don't always occur during the posting season. The military tries, for the most part, to post people and families in the summer. That way the school's done, it disrupts family life as little as possible. But you do have postings out of sequence just due to training or operational requirements. So that does happen.
Right. Okay. So you're with someone in their new town and they find one they'd like to make an offer on. Are there any special nuances or requirements in order to get the military support?
Yeah, in some cases. So home inspections are an example of that. In order to have the military pay for your home inspection, you have to have submitted a valid offer and it has to have been accepted. So you just can't pull you need to have a valid offer to make to get paid for.
Mm-hmm. Like a conditional offer.
Yes, a conditional
offer.
Okay, yeah. Then the military will reimburse you for the cost of the home inspection.
Okay, that's great.
They also have another system that works. It's the third-party service provider, and you can get that information off the BGRS relocation website. And what that does is it allows the military to bill, or sorry, the third party, like a home inspector, for example, to bill directly to the military, so the military family doesn't have to worry about that extra detail of sending money to, you know, getting the invoice, paying it, and then submitting the receipt back to BGRS or to Brookfield. It saves a lot of time. It makes it a lot easier if you use someone, a third-party service provider that is registered with Brookfield. So it makes it a little less stressful for you and one less step or one less detail you have to worry about.
Yep. And same with realtors, actually. We all have to be registered military-approved realtors. There's certain criteria. Yeah. If I recall correctly, you have to have been a professional realtor in good standing for at least 2 years before the military will even approve you.
Yes.
And as a seller, I believe you have to work with someone who is military-approved for them to pay real estate commission. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. Yes.
Okay. And we all know and appreciate in our town that on the selling side of things, the military pays a little less commission than we kind of see around our industry in our market. But we all know and appreciate that because it is military. So when you see like certain numbers, I'm not going to give away the numbers, but a certain calculation or percentage, you're like, that's a military one, just based on knowing the numbers. And we all absolutely support people coming in and out of our town.
Yeah.
So people are getting their posting notices now. When is the most common week? Is it sometime in April we're going to see people on their HHTs?
Yeah, people should be getting messages now, or at least know they're going to be getting one. And then once the new fiscal year kicks off in April, that's when people start booking their house hunting trips. And based on their urgency and their report date, it can be sooner rather than later. But yeah, April, May are definitely the busiest times for house hunting trips.
Okay, absolutely. It's interesting because in even just thinking about what we have in our pipeline right now, we have two houses going on the market that are military relocations. One of my families is going to Germany. Ooh. And the other one of our families is going to Ottawa. And then I have an incoming buyer right now that I know is getting posted into Trenton.
Yeah.
So it's definitely that time of year, right?
Yeah, everyone that I know, they got posted last year, so I don't have anyone that I'm helping going out of Kingston this year, but I'm definitely hoping to get a few people coming in this year that I'd love to help out.
Right, okay. So if you were talking to anyone, military or otherwise, what would you tell them is why you and your family decided to make Kingston your permanent home?
Oh, that's a long list. First off, the location, it's in the Thousand Islands, it's on Lake Ontario, so the city is beautiful, it's nice and old, it reminds me of a lot of where our family's from in the East Coast, St. John and Fredericton, very similar vibe. The downtown core is excellent here, there's always something going on, you know, Market Square, the Princess Street Promenade, everything's just always on the go. And I have four children, so they definitely enjoyed the activities here. The transportation system is great. The kids can hop on a bus anywhere in Kingston and they're downtown or wherever they want to be in about, you know, half hour tops. It's a very safe city. I was never concerned about my kids going around anywhere and getting into trouble or finding trouble.
Mm-hmm.
Work-wise, you know, my wife's got a great job here. The economy is great. There's always, it's a great place to be. Activities for kids. I had competitive dancer. I've got another daughter that did swimming, competitive swimming, and another one that played competitive volleyball and basketball. So yeah, the extracurricular activities for the kids is amazing. And just the life here. It's, you know, the winters, not this winter, of course, are nice and usually mild. The summers
mild.
Are great. Yeah. Patio season, you know, goes right into end of October. So yeah, just Kingston's a great place. It's almost the center of the universe, really. You know, you're 3 hours to Toronto, two to Ottawa, three-ish to Montreal. If you want to go to Syracuse, you can do that as well, too. So you're really like the center of four major cities, transportation hubs. And then the area, of course, itself is gorgeous. You go out on the Thousand Islands. You see all the different cottages and all these little places perched on rocks in the middle of the St. Lawrence. It's very interesting. Great area.
Yeah, I 100% agree with you. It's funny, I know I've mentioned this previously, but I'm a member of Toastmasters, and they often will give you impromptu topics that you have to speak on for 2 minutes. And someone asked me, this was just a gimme question for me. It was so easy. Someone asked me the other day, like, what's the three best reasons to live in Kingston? And I literally said, oh, come on, I'm a realtor. I can talk 10 great reasons to live in Kingston without even thinking about it. So that was the easiest impromptu speaking question I think I've ever been asked.
Yeah.
So you guys have a funny story. I've known you for a long time. We were friends before we worked together. And you were here, went back to the East Coast for a year to wrap up your life there officially and sell a house, and then came back to Kingston. So can you tell us anything funny about that story or the nuances of that? Because it was a funny experience, even just to witness it. I know your wife worked for a year remotely before working remotely was cool.
Yeah.
And it was just very interesting. And I loved watching that experience for you guys.
Yeah, it was just more kind of surreal because we got posted. We did all the moving back to New Brunswick. And then we're there for the year, wrapped up the career. And then we had to do the exact same thing a year later. And the kids were like, they're arguing, you know, do we take stuff out of boxes? Do we keep it in the
right
box? You know, what stuff can I live with for the next year? Yeah, it was just interesting and very quick. It was a quick turnaround. So it made it easy that you have an agent that knows what they're doing. And just to make everything easier,
because right,
it can be a very stressful time.
Okay. And what do you think that, I know recently you did a blog that's available on our website, so stageonerealestate.ca, which was a wonderful blog. I learned lots. Obviously, I wasn't in the military, so I'm learning from you. But you were talking about different types of funding and the different pockets of money that are available for people. Can you share a little bit more details about that?
Yeah, so they've called funding envelopes, and there's the core envelope, which is basically uncapped. I don't want to say it's like a blank check or anything, but those cover the core elements of your move, the selling of your home, any fees for transportation of your household goods and effects, or your furniture and all your clothing, your possessions. It pays for that. It covers your house hunting trip, flights, while you're moving to your new location. It pays for the meals, the distance that you have to drive or fly, the transportation of your vehicles if you don't drive. So that's your core envelope. The other one is your custom envelope, and that takes care of different things that you may not always have. Like if you rent an apartment, for example, and you're moving to another apartment, you obviously won't need realtor fees. But it does cover extra stuff that may not be covered in the core component, and knowing which is important, because if you need it from the custom, you have to make sure that you actually qualify for it. If you go into it's a very, unfortunately, boring document to read, but it's very, very important to understand it, the CAF relocation directive. And it outlines in there what you can and cannot claim, what's covered under the custom and what is not covered. And of course, the best advice is that if you have any questions before committing to it, talk to Brookfield or BDRS and make sure that what you're actually going to be claiming or asking about is going to be covered. Because the last thing you want to do is be on the hook for something that because you misread the directive, and then all of a sudden you're paying out of pocket.
Right. Okay. One of the interesting things that I learned about from you as well is, let's again pop back over to the seller side. We're very close to being able to officially say it's a buyer's market right now. So if you're leaving Kingston and you have to put your house on the market, it may not sell quickly.
Yeah.
Things are not selling as quickly as they used to. And I remember there was some military support, either if you don't sell or if you sell at potentially less than you bought from. So if you bought your house in 2020, 2021 during the COVID crazy, you might have overpaid. And if you can't resell for that, I remember you talking about there being some military support for, I'm going to call it top up or the differential or something. Is there funding there for that?
Yeah, so that's two things. The first one is if you have to sell your home at a loss, like you mentioned during COVID, you bought a home that was higher than what was expected, and now you're selling it, the market has changed, and unfortunately you have to list it or sell it for less than what you paid for it. In that case, the military, up to a certain point, it's not a blank check, but they will reimburse you some of the loss that you have. But you have to qualify for that as well, too, because it comes out of the custom envelope. The other one that you mentioned is the moving, sorry, if you have it listed and you have to carry a mortgage for two mortgages. So what happens is the military can help with that as well too. They can help offset some of the costs, but only for a certain period of time. Once again, that's in the directive, but they can help with if you have to carry two mortgages. If your home in, say, Kingston doesn't sell as quick as you want to, but you have to buy a house in Ottawa, well, the military will help you out with that. So you're not on the hook for carrying two mortgages at the same time. But it's not an indefinite period of time. There's certain periods of time. So it will make you a motivated seller.
Right. Okay. And I'm curious, maybe this is probably a question for a mortgage agent, but I think I do know a bit about it. There's military different interest rates for mortgages. Is there some relief or specific programs for military members that you're aware of?
Yeah, but that's not through the relocation directive or sponsored by the military. There is some banks and some different lenders will have a military rate. I'm going to do a shameless plug here for BMO because that's who I go through.
Okay.
They do have a military rate, a discount. And last I saw, it was 1% off of the interest rate. So it does make a significant difference.
Especially
when interest rates go up, that 1% makes a huge difference and can help in the pocketbook.
Oh, absolutely. 1% is a big difference for sure, right? That's interesting. I'm curious to know why you chose real estate as your second career and why it is not uncommon for people to go from military to real estate as a second career.
Yeah, that's actually a good question. I've got several friends of mine out in New Brunswick that have done the same thing I did. They retired from the military. Jim Reed, for example, his wife was a realtor in pretty much every province in Canada. And so for him, it was a natural switch over. For me, it was the same thing. We retired here to Kingston. The COVID happened, everything got locked down. So the kids were at home and you had already started real estate at this time. And I remember chatting with you occasionally over the pandemic. And you know, you were one of the few people that was still able to kind of get out of the house and go travel around and still do your work. So that was interesting. And you know, and of course, you and Terry are a very entertaining couple.
Oh, we are.
So I heard all kinds of like interest, and I thought, you know, this is interesting. And having experience moving, you know, it made me realize that, you know, my experience in the military and having bought homes or and having to buy homes and sell homes while I was in the military kind of makes sense for me to go into a real estate job because I have that experience. So I went to school while my kids were doing school. I went to the real estate college through Humber. I think it was Humber. Yeah,
you were Humber. I was before Humber,
right.
And you were Humber. I think you might have been the first set of graduates from Humber.
Yeah, probably
very
pretty
early
close
on.
Yeah. So it was neat. So my kids were all at home doing school, and I was at the kitchen table because all the office space and the bedrooms were being used as schools as well. So I did all my classes at the kitchen table and got my license in October.
Nice.
And
very good.
We joined the same brokerage.
Yeah.
In October of 2019.
Well, I've been in since 2019, so you were probably 2020.
Yeah, 2020. That's
right.
Right.
I know. It's amazing, right?
Yeah.
So how do you stay connected within the military world? I know your wife is very busy and active in social groups and particularly even like the military wives and spouse support groups and things like that. What about yourself? How do you stay active in the communities?
Well, that's one of the main methods is because she's always on there and she pokes me in the right direction sometimes that, hey, someone was asking for a realtor on a Facebook group. So that helps. But for community, you know, I stay in touch with friends of mine that I serve with. I find out when they're posted into town, when they're getting posted out, obviously. But yeah, it's actually the military is not very big and you run into people all the time. But yeah, the main way is just friends of mine that are coming into Kingston on course. They've had numerous friends come through here for training. I catch up with them, find out who's doing what and where, and then just word of mouth as well.
Yeah.
You know, I have friends of mine that have been posted here. They use me as a realtor when they're leaving, the same thing. And anyone that they know coming in, they kind of refer me word of mouth for the next people. So that's kind of how it works. And then I also have, like I mentioned, friends of mine that are realtors in New Brunswick. And, you know, if I've got a client that's going east, heading to Gagetown, I'll put them in touch with realtors out there that I know. Right. So that way you kind of have that military, you know, connection there.
Yeah, I agree with you. It's interesting. I'm going to go back to stories about Moose Jaw, but obviously I've been spending some time there. I was out visiting my daughter and her husband in Moose Jaw, and I noticed that they have lived there less than a year. and they had some friends over, I think it was Super Bowl, and they literally have like really good connections. And I was observing that I guess you have to make friends fast and deep, because you're not anywhere for any too long to develop a friendship over 10 years or something like that. So these people, they've known them for less than a year. They seem like, you know, lifelong buddies that have built some really solid, trusting relationships. And then they don't know where anybody's going on their next posting, but you may reconnect with those people, say 10 years down the line, and you've already built that natural community from everywhere that you've lived and those lived experiences together. Yeah. So I thought that was a really interesting observation, that it is connected experience. Nobody else can truly understand the experience of serving or what you go through or what military life is really like unless you've lived it. And so you're very well bonded.
Yeah, it's kind of neat. I've got friends of mine that, you know, due to work and time, you know, retirements or postings and stuff. So you haven't seen them necessarily in a few years, but, you know, you run into them again, or they're posted back, or you're posted to the same base they're at. And yeah, you basically pick up right up from where you left off. It's kind of funny that, you know, you run into a friend of yours you haven't seen in 5 years, and then you spend the next, you know, week getting caught up on what's been happening in their life. And, you know, next Sunday night, you're over their place for dinner and you haven't seen them in 4 years. It's, yeah, it's very unique. And yeah, it is actually a very enjoyable part, because, you know, that basically I can go anywhere in Canada and I know someone that lives in that province or at a base in that province.
Yeah.
And I've got friends basically in every province.
Ah, that's nice. I really like that. One of the reasons that I think that military people, and particularly yourself, make such great realtors is because you do, in this particular case, understand it. But I also like that you are professional, disciplined, always on time. Like, we all both kind of live by that. If you're 10 minutes early, you're late. Yep. You need to be 15 minutes early. And you're also no muss, no fuss, no nonsense, and no drama, which I love that about you. Yeah. Super reliable. And you just really understand that there's a mission, let's call it, to be accomplished here. And the mission is to move a family into the next chapter of their life. And so when you take that mindset and that discipline with you into what you're now doing in your day-to-day, it's really just a different way to continue to serve and facilitating that process. Yeah. So I do think that that makes, you know, for excellent groundwork to become a realtor in the future. I think that it is a great second career. A lot of people, I mean, there's people who do it obviously as a first career. We have some great young realtors in our market. I feel personally, you know, a little bit of wisdom under your belts, a couple of houses, a couple of moves, and a couple of mortgages helps you have a better appreciation for what homeowners are going through. You know, a couple of blown hot water tanks and some insurance claims later, you absolutely have a good understanding what people are going through. We're kind of almost at the end, so I wanted to ask you if there are maybe three things that you can think of that people should really keep in mind when they're getting ready for their move season. What might those be?
First one is start early. Do really good planning. Like, don't wait till the last minute to do it, because then you're scrambling and you don't want to do that. You need to minimize the stress while you're doing this. That'd be the first one. Second one is don't be afraid to ask questions. If you're moving to a new town, you're unfamiliar with it, make sure you find out where schools are, recreational facilities, what you want, and your realtor should help you find a house in the area based on your description of what you want. And the third one is, you're going to hate to hear this, is that get familiar with the relocation directive.
Right.
Because it will be deciding what gets covered and what doesn't get covered, and the timelines and all the rules that you have to live within.
Right.
So that would be my three best tips, I think, for doing a move.
Okay, perfect. Well, I'm so happy that our military supports the moves in this way. I know that there was big benefits when my son and I keep wanting to say son-in-law. They got married. I keep forgetting my daughter and her husband now. Sorry, I apologize to them. Can't get that wrapped around my tongue just yet, but I will soon. I love that they had the support that they had. And even just, you know, knowing you and the way that we've become friends, and I've been exposed to your world and even their world now, and spending some time working through this with military moves, it's such, so incredibly important that they are supported in this way, because your move, what is the frequency? Every 4 years, or could it be more frequently?
It can vary. It can be more frequent, but you're looking probably 3 to 4 years on average, depending on your position and your job.
Wow, that's very fresh. So you were in for almost 30 years, and how many times did you say you moved?
I moved only five times.
Okay, that's actually not bad.
Yeah, it was mostly towards the later part of my career that I ended up moving that many times. But yeah, other friends of mine have definitely moved way more than that.
That's good. Well, I'm glad that you landed in Kingston.
Well,
and I'm glad that you decided to make this your home and be able to work with us directly and to serve our community in this way. To our listeners, I thank you for listening along, and I hope that you have a safe day as you're finding your way home.
I find young adult fiction writing so much more fun. So people say, what's your book about? I say, well, it's a sci-fi fantasy romance story, sort of. A boy wakes up on a beach with no idea how he got there.
The United States belongs to no particular people because of race, color, or creed. People have come from many parts of the world to construct it.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell. Senegal lawmakers send increased anti-queer penalties to president, Kansas confiscation of trans IDs continues, and Guyan's queer young adult novel From Elsewhere for Everyone. Those stories and more this week because you've chosen This Way Out.
I'm Michael Taylor Gray.
And I'm Rhett.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending March 14th, 2026. Homosexuals will no longer breathe in this country, according to one Senegalese MP, during debate on a bill to double the punishments for same-sex sexual activity. The National Assembly passed the measure almost unanimously on March 11th, with only 3 of the 135 members abstaining. Those convicted of consensual adult queer sex will now face 5 to 10 years in prison, the maximum penalty for sex with a person under 21. It's also a no-promo-homo law carrying 3 to 7 years in jail for supporting LGBTQ causes. Hefty fines are also included. The bill was a campaign promise of President Bassirou Diomaye Faye and Prime Minister Ousmane Sonko. Sonko failed to get it passed as an opposition MP in 2021. Faye is expected to sign it into law, and quickly. UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Volker Turk said the new law flies in the face of the sacrosanct human rights we all enjoy, the rights to respect, dignity, privacy, equality, and freedoms of expression, association, and peaceful assembly. He urged Faye not to sign the bill. Senegal is not the only Western African nation contemplating new anti-LGBTQ laws. Ghana's dormant, draconian Human Sexual Rights and Family Values Bill is once again working its way through the legislative pipeline.
The conviction of the perpetrators who violently robbed and attempted to extort 2 gay friends in Kenya is being hailed as a landmark victory for the country's LGBTQ community. The 2 assailants were sentenced to 15 years in prison. They had lured their victims to a home in 2023. They beat them, held them at knife point, and forced them to transfer money under the threat of being killed or outed to their families. The National Gay and Lesbian Human Rights Commission alleges the existence of a larger criminal network that specifically targets queer men. They charge that local security services are often complicit. In a nation where consensual same-sex intimacy remains criminalized, this rare legal victory offers a sign of hope. Activists believe the sentence will serve as a powerful deterrent against the rising tide of targeted blackmail and extortion facing the queer community.
A U.S. federal appeals court has issued a precedent-setting ruling against government-funded gender-affirming surgery. A panel of the 4th Circuit Court of Appeals decided that states have a rational interest in encouraging citizens to appreciate their sex. The judges also sided with West Virginia's stance that states may legitimately refuse to fund procedures they deemed experimental or dangerous. Therefore, they believe states should be able to exclude gender-affirming surgery from Medicaid coverage. This March 10th ruling differs from the U.S. Supreme Court's recent Scarametti decision in a major way. It extends gender-affirming care restrictions to transgender adults for the first time. It's also the first decision from a federal appeals court to explicitly apply the legal framework used for minor care bans to adult health care. Legal experts are alarmed at the court's suggestion that if a state can refuse to pay for such care, it may also have the power to ban it entirely. The ruling faces sharp criticism from medical professionals who maintain that gender-affirming surgery is a medically necessary evidence-based treatment for gender dysphoria.
A different U.S. federal judge has ruled on the side of transgender health care rights. In Connecticut, District Judge Victor Bolden says that Aetna Life Insurance must reconsider its denial of coverage for gender-affirming facial reconstruction surgeries. Bolden rejected Aetna's motion to dismiss a proposed class action lawsuit, finding that the company's categorical exclusion of these procedures is likely discriminatory under the Affordable Care Act. The ruling includes a preliminary injunction requiring Aetna to reassess the denied claims of two transgender women. Bolden emphasized that denying access to this medically necessary care constitutes irreparable harm by continuing to aggravate the plaintiff's gender dysphoria.
New York Attorney General Letitia James is ordering NYU Langone Health to immediately resume its transgender youth health program. She says that its recent closure violates state non-discrimination laws. U.S. President Donald Trump's threatened cuts to the federal funding of hospitals that offer gender-affirming care to minors led the New York City health provider to shutter the program in February. In a letter to the hospital, James's office defined transgender youth as a protected class and warned that it is illegal to deny them medically necessary care while providing similar treatment to non-transgender patients. Officials emphasized that the sudden discontinuation of such care can lead to severe negative health outcomes for a vulnerable population. James maintains that federal pressure does not override state requirements. She promises further action if the hospital fails to comply.
A Kansas judge is refusing to block a sweeping new law that invalidates the driver's licenses of transgender Kansans and criminalizes their use of public bathrooms. Douglas County District Judge James McCabria denied a request for a temporary restraining order against Senate Bill 244 on March 10th. The law that was fast-tracked by the legislature earlier this year mandates that all state-issued IDs reflect sex assigned at birth. It's also been called a bounty bill in that it creates a private right of action. Individuals can sue those they suspect of using the wrong restroom for up to $1,000 in damages. The ACLU argued that the law causes irreparable harm to trans people. They claim that their ability to hold a job, go to school, or go about their daily lives is threatened, but the judge said they failed to prove the law would lead to widespread harassment. Kansas Attorney General Chris Kobach made one small concession. Trans people's invalidated IDs won't be added to law enforcement databases until March 26th. However, the law remains in full effect as the legal challenge continues.
Unfortunately, Kansas is not the only U.S. state targeting the rights of its transgender residents. One of the nation's most extreme transgender bathroom bans just passed the New Hampshire House of Representatives. The legislation mandates that a person's so-called biological sex determine their use of facilities in public buildings, including parks and airports. The bill offers a unique enforcement mechanism. Asserting one's gender identity to access the prohibited spaces is the criminal act. As civil rights violations, Every rest stop could result in a fine of up to $5,000 and jail time. It lets private businesses off the hook for discrimination lawsuits if they restrict bathroom access based on sex assigned at birth. Advocates warn the measure puts the state at odds with its New England neighbors, who hold a long-standing pro-LGBTQ rights consensus. The bill's move to the state Senate makes New Hampshire part of the national legislative campaign targeting transgender rights.
Not to be left out of the war on transgender people this week, President Trump has shoehorned it into his top legislative priority, the Save America Act. Yes, it could get even worse. Trump now says he won't sign any pending legislation into law unless Congress adds anti-transgender provisions to his cherished voter suppression bill. It's not enough that the bill mandates voters present in-person proof of citizenship. In a recent Truth Social post, Trump demanded that it also be expanded to include a national ban on pediatric gender-affirming care, as well as a ban on transgender athletes in competitive sports. White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt confirmed the new strategy, describing the additions as common sense priorities. However, the move does nothing to break the stalemate in the United States Senate and the Democrats' promised filibuster.
Finally,
do you trust me?
I trust you.
Cue the romantic music and open your eyes near the reflecting pool in Washington, D.C.'s National Mall. There at sunset in all their bronze glory, is it Jack and Rose on the bow of the Titanic? No, it's Donald Trump and Jeffrey Epstein riding high together in an unauthorized sculpture entitled The King of the World. Secret Handshake is the organization behind this and other satirical Trump statues that have appeared on the mall in recent months. The caption on this one reads, "The tragic love story between Jack and Rose was built on luxurious travel, raucous parties, and secret nude sketches." This monument honors the bond between Donald Trump and Jeffrey Epstein, a friendship seemingly built on luxurious travel, raucous parties, and secret nude sketches. The installation hit its permanent iceberg on March 13th when, like the mock Gilded Age friendship it parodies, it took a dive.
That's News Wrap, global queer news with attitude, for the week ending March 14th, 2026. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap was written by David Hunt and Lucia Chappelle, produced by Brian DeShazer, and brought to you by you.
Thank you. Help keep us in ears around the world at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast and much more. For This Way Out, I'm Rhett. Stay healthy.
And I'm Michael Taylor Gray. Stay safe.
Hi, this is Thorgy Thor, and you are listening to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine heard on over 200 radio stations worldwide, the World Radio Network, and on the World Wide Web. Keep listening.
You're listening to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. Now it's time to rewind the rainbow. This is The Rainbow Rewind,
where we take a quick look back at the people and the moments that made queer history.
I'm Brian DeShazer.
And I'm Sherry Lund.
This week, we honor the March birthdays of Bayard Rustin and Donkil Hefner.
Born March 17th, 1912, openly gay Bayard Rustin was best known as being the architect of the first March on Washington for Civil Rights.
The United States belongs to no particular people because of race, color, or creed. People have come from many parts of the world to construct it.
Donkil Hefner was a founding member of the Gay Liberation Front in Los Angeles in 1970. That was one of the first organizations to bring gay rights to the general public's attention in the United States. He also co-founded the LA Gay Community Services Center in 1971, which later became the Los Angeles LGBT Center. And if that wasn't enough, he was also a co-founder of the spiritual, countercultural Radical Fairies movement.
Pleased to have Don Kilhefner and Mark Thompson with me on the 30th anniversary of the Radical Fairies.
We cast a sacred circle in fairy love. We cast a sacred circle in fairy love. We cast a sacred circle in fairy love. We cast a sacred circle.
Now let's rewind to a few March key queer milestones. In March 2021, Dr. Rachel Levine became the first out transgender federal official to be confirmed by the Senate. In 2006, Brokeback Mountain, Capote, and Transamerica all received Oscars. And in 1997, the Clinton administration convened the first official meeting to discuss gay and lesbian rights at the White House.
A reminder that our history is built on courage, creativity, and community.
That's this week's Rainbow Rewind, because remembering our past fuels our pride. I'm Brian DeShazer.
And I'm Sherry Lund. Stay tuned. More This Way Out is coming up.
Our listeners support This Way Out in many ways.
By subscribing to our e-newsletter.
Email us at info@thiswayout.org.
And through your financial contributions to our program.
More information about how you can give is online at thiswayout.org.
Thank you.
Kestrel Guyon is a storyteller. A queer storyteller. At a time when queer stories, queer voices, are cast as dangerous, purveyors of a radical ideology that blurs the traditional boundaries of gender identity and sexual expression. And it's true that this thoughtful, soft-spoken Brit is, in a decidedly understated manner, changing the narrative. Crafting characters, stories, even alternate universes that are familiar yet radically different, where the past and present collide, where life and death are states of mind, where love is love. Softness, Guyon writes, feels like a form of resistance. Stories should leave a mark, not a scar. I'm David Hunt. I sat down with Kestrel Guyon recently, shortly after the release of their newest book, The Boy from Elsewhere, a young adult novel that combines time travel, alternate realities, and an ancient bloodline, and includes queer characters and a same-sex romance. I asked Guyon about the audience they write for.
In terms of the fiction books that I write for a mainly young adult audience, although I write for young adult and upwards. I think young adult fiction that is aimed at sort of 13 or 14 plus is actually really at its best when it is also accessible for adults who want a lighter read. The world is such a difficult place to live in right now for everyone. And, you know, sometimes grown-ups, sometimes the adults want a break from that and to read something a bit more entertaining and a bit easier to engage with and a bit easier to digest. So I suppose in terms of the fiction that I write, it is for teenagers and young adults and adults who are looking for some escapism that is a little bit less heavy duty than reading Tolkien, for example. As much as I love reading Tolkien, there's a time and a place. But I do write other things as well. I write poetry, which has a kind of broad adult audience mostly, and do some writing in and around theatre that's mostly aimed at adults as well. So broad set of audiences for the stuff that I do, but I find young adult fiction writing so much more fun because it's an audience that doesn't tolerate being patronized in any way, but it is an audience that is broad and diverse and just so fun to write for.
Yeah, and I have to admit, I'm not a consumer of young adult fiction. And so I didn't know what to expect when I read your books. And then I was sort of flummoxed. I was like, I love this book. What does that say about me? Am I just young at heart, or is there something universal about the writing?
I think good young adult fiction is quite universal. I think young adult just means, it's a bit of an odd label, really. It just means accessible fiction. And I don't think you have to be young at heart, or I don't think there has to be any kind of shame in adult readers wanting something that's accessible to read now and then. I think it's such an interesting place we've got ourselves into, in the same way that, you know, poetry scholars are very gatekeepy around poetry and who can enjoy it and how they should enjoy it and those kind of things. We've got ourselves into this kind of place in the world where we say, no, grown-ups should read difficult books. Books should, you know, books should be hard to get through. Books should make you think. Books should, you should take 3 months to read a book. And actually, sometimes it's nice to have something that's more accessible, and there shouldn't be any shame around that at all. It should just be another thing that people can enjoy.
So your new book, The Boy from Elsewhere, when people ask you that haven't read it, ask you about it, how do you describe that book in a sort of the elevator speech, I guess, fashion?
Oh, so it's very genre bending, which I have been very intentional about. So people say, what's your book about? I say, well, it's a sci-fi fantasy romance story, sort of. A boy wakes up on a beach with no idea how he got there and meets someone else, and they decide to help them and end up on this adventure, kind of gathering friends and family around them and end up saving the world. And it's as random and as kind of unusual in its development as that. Like, we learn what's going on as the characters do, and we see kind of glimpses into the pasts of various different characters through a few sort of diary entries and things like that throw back. But ultimately, the book is about coming together, celebrating differences, helping each other, lifting each other up, and then becoming greater than the sum of our parts in the service of something huge.
And so you craft the story by telling it from different points of view, from different times even. The time sort of is, it's very fluid.
Yes, and so this book is the first book in a series as well. So there are many things in the first book that I have deliberately included and left dangling, because that's a much bigger thread in book two or book three as a three-part series. And so it's been really fun actually writing a book knowing that it's part of a series, because that's giving me the opportunity to introduce concepts but not have to resolve that until later. Which I think has proven interesting in the feedback I've been getting from readers. I've had more than a dozen messages pop into various inboxes online from people that have just said, how dare you end on a cliffhanger? I want to know. I want a resolution to all these things, which is, of course, coming. But I like the fact that I haven't had to tie up every loose end by the end of book one.
Some of your young characters seem wise beyond their years. And I think that in a lot of ways contradicts the prevailing media narrative about the Generation Z as being sort of clueless or being overly sheltered. Why did you choose to make your young characters, you know, sort of resilient and wise? I mean, was that a conscious choice, or is that something that's reflected in your experiences with young people?
Yeah, I mean, they're there because they're based largely on real people. Particularly Ellie in this most recent book, who is 13 and just so resilient and strong-minded and clever, is based on a young person that I know, as the daughter of someone that I've worked with. And, you know, that these people absolutely exist in their kind of strong-willed glory. And I think it's really important to show that there are people like that in the world, and that young people aren't all growing up in this kind of content-infused nightmare, that some people are continuing to just grow up and be brilliant and unique in themselves. And that does echo a lot of my experience growing up as well. I think, yeah, I'm autistic, and growing up in that world of you know, being an autistic LGBTQ plus young person at a time where none of those things were really talked about was an interesting experience. And I have seen the confidence of newer generations growing up without some of the same restraints. And I think actually writing those characters is really important, and writing characters that are role models that I would have needed when I was that age as well is really important.
Yeah. You write on your website about growing up in a home where there wasn't a lot of money, and growing up as a queer kid. You write about feeling a sense of difference and desiring having a deep desire for connection with others. And that certainly informs your writing. How would it not?
Absolutely. I think ultimately, you know, writers bring so much of themselves to any story, as do readers. I mean, the second a story is out there in the world, it is read through the lens of the reader. So every different person that reads something that I've written will come to it with a different set of expectations, a different set of experiences in life. And, you know, I can only hope that the experiences that I have had that bleed through into the writing vibe well with the experiences that other people have had as they start to read the writing.
And then how can people find you online?
So I have some social media. I'm on Instagram, aes.tr.al, where you'll find quite a lot of pictures of food, because I quite enjoy food. I can also be found on Blue Sky and on Mastodon using the same handles. But mostly these days via my website, so kestr.al, where I semi-regularly update a newsletter, and there's various bits of information around how to find me all through there.
I'd like to thank Kestrel Guyon for talking with me for this program. Check out their newest book, The Boy from Elsewhere, a young adult queer adventure that speaks to the young adult in all of us. For This Way Out, I'm David Hunt.
Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. News Wrap was reported this week by Rhett and Michael Taylor Gray and produced by Brian DeShazer. The Rainbow Rewind was written and produced by Sherry Lunn and co-host Brian DeShazer. Tycho Tycho performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks Richard Merck and Brad Payton of Silicon Valley, in memory of Greg Gordon for his years of service to the LGBT community, and all the listener donors who make this program possible. Ask us about how you can join them. Look for This Way Out Radio on social media, email us at info@thiswayout.org, or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For everyone at This Way Out, I'm Lucia Chappell. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org or wherever you get your podcasts, and on CKDU Halifax, Nova Scotia, KCUR Riverside, California, WWUH West Hartford, Connecticut, and a wide array of community terrestrial and internet radio stations around the world, including this one. Stay healthy, stay safe, and stay tuned, y'all.
Welcome to Songwriters from Here and Away. This is a show that focuses on new and established songwriters from Atlanta, Canada, across Canada, and around the world. Hello and welcome to Songwriters from Here and Away. My name is Robert Campbell, and this episode is quite exciting for me. It's one of the song circles that we recorded at the Pink Piano in Lower Sackville, Nova Scotia. This episode has Mike Bigger from Quispam Sis of New Brunswick, as well as Laura Ray from Halifax, Nova Scotia, and John Cornwall, also from Halifax. Three very different performers, and it's really quite fun to be able to be in the room and share the stage with them. Here they are, Mike, Laura, and John.
We were talking about songwriting around the table over there just before we sort of came up, and everybody was sort of talking about what they've been up to, and I haven't been doing as much